Folks, welcome back to the iHealth channel, the Nutritious channel, iHealth Radio, the network. New day, new show. A topic we've touched on, but never enough discussion on this topic, because it is a topic that is alive and it remains alive. It's been alive for centuries. It's going to continue being alive. It affects a lot of people. And there are things that we can do about it. And it can be detrimental, despite the benefits that some may see, you know, of this not being a little bit of suspenseful right now. But the idea is we're going to talk about the alcohol consumption and what it does, the mental, the social, the physical, the financial, you know, the nutrition effects and all the whole things that, you know, we can talk with my guest, who actually has a story with alcohol himself, but he's turned that into a whole different work of helping others get out of it, do better, seek a better life, as well as he's a writer, author, speaker. He interviews, you know, the top, la crema de la crema, as they say, you know, and how they manage through the alcohol phases for those of them that had, you know, challenge there. So without any further ado, I have with me Duncan Bhaskaran Brown, all the way from the UK. Duncan, welcome to the show, man.
Oh no! Thanks for having you. Thanks for having me, man. I'm looking forward to getting into a bit of a discussion.
Well, it's gonna be heavy, right? I mean, alcohol is like the social thing. I mean, you cannot get into a gathering or a party or festivity without having some sort of alcohol, right? Yet, it is you know, it's a great industry. I mean, when I say great, you know, I'm not giving it any credit, but it's great in terms of, you know, big finances, you know, and big money in there and stuff like that. So, and it's amazing how it works. And we can, you know, I can later on, we'll talk about, you know, stuff, and I'll give a little bit of an interesting fact that I noticed a couple of years back. But anyway, so first things first, Duncan, tell us about your story with alcohol, because you've had one and it was a longer one or a long one, I would say.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess like a lot of people, I found life sort of a bit challenging in the teenage years. You know, you want to be cool and you want to impress the girls and all of that. And I was kind of a little bit nervous, a little bit shy. I didn't really know what my place was in life. And, you know, I found myself at a party one day, you know, nervous, want to go and talk to the girl, but too scared to do it. One of my friends handed me a can of beer. Like, it didn't taste that great, did it? You know, but after a little while, I start to get, you know, the tingling in the feet kind of moves up. It gets into, and all of a sudden I feel, you know, I feel good. I feel like getting on the dance floor. And I impressed the girl. You know, the rest is history kind of thing. For me, alcohol just seemed to fill in a lot of gaps. It seemed to, you know, really provide me with a lot of solutions to a lot of problems that I had at the time. And it seemed to be doing a lot for me. But as I went on, the amount I drank kind of increased, but the amount of people I drank with decreased. You know, it got less and less social. And eventually I just found myself pretty much on my own all of the time, drinking, you know, two bottles of wine every day after work. And you know what? It's just not that much fun.
You know, it's amazing, because what you stated there is probably the majority of the humans on earth today. You know, at a younger age, I mean, first of all, it depends on the culture and the place and you know, the parts of the world. It is a very social thing to have alcohol. And even in family, you know, as early, you know, ages, you know, kids sometimes in family are introduced to wine as part of, you know, a nice aperitif, you know, in their drink, you know, during the meal, right? You know, with lunch or dinner or whatever. So it's acceptable. As a matter of fact, it's funny, because a couple of years back, I was on a cruise ship in Italy, from Italy, and the kids were allowed to drink there. I'm like, you know, so now imagine coming from the US, and the ships in the US, there's no, you have to have, you know, a certain age to actually, I think it's 21 to drink, right? So it was like, well, my kids were like, well, kids can drink here and smoke. I was like, well, we're in Europe, it's different, right? But you know, that's just one thing. But it is, like, for example, I'm originally from Morocco, so I got a little bit of a French culture in me, because I grew up with, back in the days, it was more French Morocco than it is today, I would say, to a degree. And you know, even in Morocco, I mean, they do make their own wine, believe it or not. So it sounds weird, you know, especially it's a Muslim country, but it is. And there is alcohol in Morocco, to just some people that don't think that there is. It's not a cool thing, but it is. It's happening. People actually adopt it, you know. And I'm giving the extreme side of the culture, because when you think of Muslim countries, alcohol is frowned upon and stuff. But even in some of the countries that you can visit, Egypt, Morocco, I mean, Dubai, you know, you name it, alcohol now is available readily. And that's the thing. So it's a thing across the world, and people get affected younger. And then, as you said, one of the main reasons, especially when in the social settings, is that you want to get braver. I would say, you know, you want to put some audacity, and you know, you become audacious, and you can go in there and do your thing and bust a move and all whatever. But as you said, you know, your circles eventually will drop, and it becomes a problem, because now it's an addiction. And like everything else, it starts with one drink, one beer, one sip, and or one smoke, and the rest, you know, is history. And it doesn't take long before you realize that, well, you realize it, but you can't do anything about it. Most people are aware that they have a problem, but they can't get rid of the problem, because it just feels good. And if you stop, you just want more. And because it also touches on your mental abilities, or not mental, but really your brain. I mean, it gives you that nice kick, you know, the nice, you know, happy, you know, feeling, and that's it. So now, how long was it for you before you really kind of took steps, and what were the steps you took?
So, I mean, I drank pretty solidly for about 20 years. And it's funny because people say to me, oh, when did you realize that it was a problem? And I don't think I realized the scale of the problem until I stopped, you know, until I started to experience life without alcohol. That was when I started to realize how much of an effect it was having on me. I mean, I knew it was getting in the way of a few things, and it was definitely causing a lot of problems within my relationship. You know, on one level, I was quite successful, but I wasn't really doing the kind of things that I wanted to do. I was doing the kind of things that people expected me to do. So, yeah, it came to a head when my wife and I we were trying to start a family, and well, I mean that was quite good fun to start off with, and you know my wife got pregnant, and we were that kind of like that typically stupid couple, you know, they're just like totally naive kind of thing, and it was all fun and games until, you know, it wasn't, and my wife had a miscarriage, and everything just fell apart, you know. And then I knew that I had to do something about it then. You know, I never stared in the mirror at 4 a.m. and had one of those blinding realizations. But over the course of a couple of months, I look back on it now, and I know I was asking myself one question, and that was, you know, what do you want? What do you want? What do you want to do with your life, Duncan? You know, do you want another drink, or do you want to have a family? So I decided that, you know, having a family was more important than having a drink. And to get the other side of it, in essence, what I did was I approached the beliefs that I had around alcohol. You know, I believed that I depended on alcohol. I believed that I couldn't make my life work without alcohol. I couldn't handle stress. I couldn't socialize. I couldn't relax without alcohol. So I looked at that, you know, and I asked myself, is that true? And it's not. You know, after a bit of time wrestling with those beliefs and a little bit of work around the thought process, some people would probably call them cravings, but ultimately, cravings happen in your head, ergo they are just thoughts. You know, a little bit to manage that thought process, and you know, I came out the other side. I can put my hand on my heart and say there has never been a moment since that I've wanted to drink.
Well, I mean, sorry to hear that, you know, it took a drastic, you know, event, you know, And I mean, it's a wake up call at that time, and you did the right thing. And I love what you said. It is in your head. It is your mind. I mean, obviously the chemicals and the body craves because it's got used to some stuff. Now that's the thing. You know, now we can touch on the health aspect of it. You know, I mean, so the social aspect of it is obviously there's some benefits to it because it makes you like cool, or it makes you feel like you're Superman and you can do a lot of things. But at the same time, you get the aftershock, right? The aftermath. Like the next day, you got the headaches, you got the migraines, you got the, you know, the, I don't know, the maybe the nausea, you know, all the stuff that can happen with it. I mean, I have not experienced it, but I know people who have, and I've seen it. It could be very brutal, you know, when you see people in pain going through the next day of alcohol. And again, it depends on what level of alcohol. I mean, you mentioned wine specifically. Now, wine as a whole, it is probably one of the lesser, you know, dangerous types of alcohol, you know, that out there. I mean, you have a lot more critical stuff, the heavy liquors and all the other stuff, which is heavy. And I know you're going to touch on some of the industry and some of the statistics, hopefully, and on what alcohol industry is and what's out there. But really, it does affect, you know, on that side. And so when you balance out the pros and cons in of having, you know, those nice little drinks, you know, it doesn't really equate well, right? So that's one. Two, you know, there is a cost to it too. I mean, I'm sure if you add it up, it adds up quite a bit over the year of how much you spend on alcohol. It's not cheap. Now, if you want something good, it's not cheap. Obviously, you can get cheap version of it, which would be pretty much just pure alcohol with a lot of sugar. And maybe I'm guessing here. And then you have the nutritious piece of it, right? You know, now, there is a lot of sugar in alcohol, and it does, you know, can cause problems for people, especially sweet stuff. And wine is very sweet, and it's obviously grape, you know, so it does have a lot of sugar, and alcohol in general, doesn't matter what it is, it does give you that. And that's something that people don't realize as a correlation between alcohol and sugar and maybe diabetes and some other stuff. We know alcohol also damages the liver because the body, you know, the liver needs to detox, and, you know, it gets a burden. A lot of people have problems with their liver over the years if they're heavy alcoholic, you know, trends, right? So it's difficult. So what have you, I guess, discovered throughout your journey about the health aspect of it from your own perspective and or, you know, the collective? Because you've done the work and you also interviewed a lot of people who had similar stuff. What is some of the common stuff that you've heard that touched you in terms of financial health and nutrition, all the above?
Yeah, I mean, I think you hit on quite an important point just to start off with. There are quite a lot of calories in alcohol. Yeah, there's a lot of sugar in it. In essence, alcohol, like ethanol, it does not taste very nice. Therefore, people have to, you know, give it some flavor over and above just the ethanol. I mean, that's the purpose of cocktails, isn't it? It's the idea is to disguise the taste of alcohol. But even in wine and beer, there's an awful lot of sugar in it that sort of detracts from the actual taste of the alcohol. So whatever you're drinking, it's probably going to be about the same as a couple of scoops of ice cream. And I think if people started to think about alcohol like that, they would probably pause a little bit, because it's all right. You know, like, I've got no problem with eating ice cream. As before, we were chatting before we started, unusually in the UK, the weather is really good at the moment. It's really, really hot. It's the kind of time to have some ice cream, you know. That's fine. You have ice cream occasionally when the weather is good. That's all right. But, you know, you have two scoops. You don't have two scoops and you think, oh, I'll have another couple of scoops in half an hour, and then another couple of scoops after that. And you don't eat, you know, 16 scoops of ice cream in one evening, do you? But people will keep going back to the bar, won't they? And they'll drink after drink after drink. And I think to sort of see it as it is, you know, that makes people think of it a little bit differently. And of course, I'm sure, you know, your listeners are aware that actually drinking calories is, you know, it's like the worst kind of thing, because it doesn't provide you with any nutritional benefit. It doesn't even make you feel fuller. So it's got a lot of disadvantages from that point of view. In terms of your gut microbiome, it's pretty bad for that. So it will get to the point where you know, it will compromise your body's ability to absorb certain vitamins. So most people who drink a reasonable amount, you don't even have to drink that heavily, but you know, that will compromise your ability, particularly with the B vitamins. So most drinkers are pretty deficient in those B vitamins. What else? Yeah, and it can make your gut leaky. So drink enough, it will give you leaky gut syndrome. It's all manner of just like problems around nutrition and general health. Then we can go into sleep. That's a huge one. And again, I'm sure your listeners are the kind of people who are more switched on, and they're more aware of the power and the value of sleep. And alcohol compromises your sleep, which surprises a lot of people because they think, oh no, alcohol makes me sleepy. How can it do that? Yeah, yeah. But it does affect your sleep, and it starts at a very small level. So just one glass of wine, you know, just one drink is enough to actually have a measurable impact on your sleep. A couple of glasses is going to reduce your the quality of your sleep by about 24%, and that's going to attack, you know, the deepest part of your sleep, the really important part of your sleep, where you lay down memories, where you grow, where you process emotions. So you know, that's at a relatively low level. People think, oh, two drinks, you know, nothing wrong with having a couple of drinks. But actually, it has a significant impact on your sleep. In terms of sporting performance, alcohol has a massive impact on your recovery. Again, I'm sure your listeners are very familiar with the idea of inflammation and, you know, sport. Any sort of like serious exercise causes inflammation. So to recover from exercise, you want things that are anti-inflammatory. Alcohol, unfortunately, is pro-inflammatory. So absolutely the worst time to drink alcohol is immediately after you've exercised, which is when most amateur sports people drink it, isn't it? So, I mean, it attacks everything. It dehydrates you, doesn't it? So all of those kind of pillars of well-being, of health, diet, activity, sleep, and hydration, it's bad for all of them. So, you know, I think it's something that we need to help people to understand a little bit more, the effect that it does have on your well-being, on your resilience, on your sporting performance.
Well, Duncan, you know, I mean, just listening to you, I'm sure people are just like wondering, well, why do we even have this? Why is it a big industry? Why is it, you know, people still kind of feel the need for this, right? You know, in festivities and stuff like that. I mean, in parts of the world, there's like beer gardens, right? You know, that you have, right? I mean, I remember one of my trips to Germany, and we went to Munich, and you know, you're in Munich, you got to go to the beer garden. I mean, not drunk, but you know, you go there just because that's where people do. An example. So there's an anchored version of alcohol everywhere. You mentioned bars, people hop to bars everywhere. As soon as there's a festivity, you know, TGIFs, right? It's Friday night, happy hour. Thursday night, happy hour. It's very attractive. You can't even have a restaurant that is doing good if you don't have alcohol in it, right? I mean, it's almost like a sad, you know, statement, but, you know, many, you know, restaurants that don't have a liquor license, for example, at least in the States, they don't thrive well the same way if they had a bar, you know, into their stuff. You know, the bring your own stuff doesn't really work as well, right? And so there's all these things. Industries are huge. I mean, you look at the Super Bowl for us, the World Cup, right? Beer is there. I mean, it's like, you know, the big guys, Budweiser, all these guys are, you know, out there in full presence, right? You know, and they're sponsoring these things, big money. So there's money to be made, and industries are all attached to it. I mean, there is almost nothing that you cannot do these days. You go to work, I mean, even work, sometimes they have parties and things like that. And there is like a bar, right? You know, at those parties. Now, we can talk about the problem with alcohol and the job and the employment, because it can really cause a lot of problems to a lot of people when you wake up in the morning and go, you know, you don't show up to your work, or you show up with a bad breath, or, you know, sometimes really just still stuck, you know, like, you know, a little bit tipsy, you know. So all these things are, can, you know, problematic. And, you know, listen, I've seen people actually who had, you know, alcohol addiction and come to work and they lose their job because of that. You know, it's sad, but it is real. So this stuff is big, but it is big money. And so in your venture, in your work, What have you discovered? I mean, why is it just as big as it is? And you know, as much as we can enumerate all the bad things, people still do it. I mean, now someone can say, well, it's just like everything else, but why alcohol specifically?
I mean, I think you've hit on quite a few very interesting points there. And you mentioned the Super Bowl and Budweiser. Budweiser is actually one of the two of the top 10 sponsors. You know, they publish lists of who pays the most for the commercials in the Super Bowl, don't they? And Budweiser is always in twice, once for Bud and once for Bud Light. So yeah, very much. And there's of course a huge irony behind that because a significant amount of the recent Super Bowls have been won by and I know he's a bit of a wedge issue. He's not popular with everybody, but you can't argue with the fact that he is fairly good at football. And of course, he doesn't drink. And I think that is one of the big ironies with sporting performance. You know, they spray the champagne at the end of the Formula One Grand Prix, don't they? Yeah, Lewis Hamilton, he doesn't drink either. So few sports people these days drink because, you know, they've done even more research on it than I have. They know how bad it is for sporting performance. They know how much it affects their recovery. So either they, you know, drink only outside of the season, or they just don't drink at all. I mean, you look at Cristiano Ronaldo. So we just had the European Championships. Cristiano Ronaldo played in his sixth European Championship. You know, he's still competing at the highest level. And yes, he has a huge regime of how he looks after himself to, you know, produce that elite sporting performance for so long. But part of that is the fact that he doesn't drink. And I think that's the irony that a lot of sport is used to sell alcohol, yet the people that are excelling in it, they don't drink it at all. So, you know, why do we allow it to continue? Well, that is a very interesting question. I think the alcohol industry is big and they spend an awful lot of money on lobbying, and it works. So if you just look at the European Union spends over 1 billion euros every year subsidizing the wine industry. They spend over 1.5 billion euros every year subsidizing the beer industry. So, you know, they're doing quite well when it comes to politicians. But of course, if it was actually invented today, you know, there's no way we would allow alcohol to be legal. We certainly wouldn't be encouraging our children to drink it. In fact, if you put alcohol through the food additive tests that they have in the European Union, so anything that you want to add to a food product that's invented now has to go through these tests. Some scientists put alcohol through it for fun, I suppose, recently. And what they concluded was the safe dose of alcohol is somewhere around 2 units. And people go, oh yeah, 2 units a day, Duncan, that's not too much, not too bad. It's not 2 units a day, 2 units a week, it's not a week, 2 units a month, nope, 2 units a year. That is the maximum amount you'd be allowed to put in people's food if you invented alcohol today. So it's very much kind of tied up with the political system. Alcohol companies spend a lot of money keeping politicians sweet because they don't want them to realize the basic fact that alcohol costs our society a huge amount of money. There's been research done in the UK, in Canada, in the US, and every time it comes to the same conclusion that the tax revenue generated by alcohol sales is far smaller than the cost to the government in terms of policing, in terms of social care, in terms of healthcare. And, you know, that's just the direct cost to the government. If you look at the actual cost to the economy in terms of lost productivity, not people simply coming in to work, you know, a little bit hungover. You know, we're just talking about people coming into work after having a drink or two. And you have to bear in mind that in the US, some study recently found that 47% of high-earning college graduates drink every other day. So if you go into a lawyer's office, it's basically a 50-50 as to whether they drank last night or not. And that's not really very reassuring if, you know, I don't know, that lawsuit is important to you. Or if you go into a hospital, you know, the doctor, it's a 50-50 chance they drank last night. And yeah, you're hoping that you're having your surgery on a good day, don't you? So in terms of lost productivity and in terms of the effect that it has on people's jobs, it's massive. In fact, the CDC calculated the percentage, and applying that to last year's economic figures, the lost productivity in the American economy, it's going to be something like $400 billion last year, which is about the same as Apple's entire turnover.
Ooh. Scary numbers, scary statistics, and definitely, you know, first of all, you've talked about, you know, some elite sport, you know, stars, and you literally clear stated, you know, the obvious, these guys don't partake in the practice of drinking alcohol, yet, you know, it is all around them. As a matter of fact, it's funny because even the World Cup in Qatar last year, right, Budweiser was still there. And yes, I mean, it is a Muslim country, and they kind of made some rules around how the drinks and all the stuff's going to be and what will be served and so on and so forth. Because Budweiser even had the, you know, they have the zero, you know, alcohol stuff too now. You know, I mean, I think all the beer companies have done the zero, the Heineken's and all the stuff, because they realized, like, you know, well, we can still get some action for those guys that don't drink, right? You know, but it's in, go ahead.
Well, I think that's one of the ironies that now a lot of beer companies, they, to try and promote a more healthy image, they, the sponsorship deal that they have with football clubs now is often their 0% brand. But of course, that is just the name of their beer company with the number zero after it. So it's not like they are advertising anything differently. You can then also get kind of cynical about it and talk about line extensions. So, you know, like Coke has got like 87 different flavors, you know, like you can get Coke mango and Coke chili banana chocolate chip these days. And it's not because there is any genuine demand out there for that. It's just the more bottles of Coke you can get on the shelf, the less space there is for Pepsi and Dr. Pepper. So they keep coming up with these different versions of it to try and crowd out the competition. And that is effectively what they're doing with 0% beer. If you put a 0% Heineken tap on a bar, it means there's less space for another beer brand on there. So, yeah, whilst, you know, I'm a fan of alcohol-free beer, if it's going to help you to drink less, you know, I'm absolutely a fan of it. I think we've got to be a little bit cynical, particularly in terms of sponsorship. They're promoting their brand and just sticking the number zero at the end of it.
You know, speaking of sponsorship, you gotta give them credit. I mean, they do come up with some crazy ads, man. I mean, I remember, was it 90s? What's up? You know, like, I don't know if you remember that one. That was one of the iconic ones. I mean, they do use good creative, you know, and talent to market their products, and they're good at it. I mean, you know, if you look at even wine,
they've
right?
Got it's the same. To.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, it's big.
Yeah, they've got to, because what they're selling is poison. And there's another thing about the alcohol industry. It spends about three times more on advertising than industries do in general, for the simple reason that, you know, what they're selling you is effectively a lie. You know, they're saying, look, you know, drink the beer and the girls in bikinis will be flocking around after you. And that is just not true. So yeah, of course, you know, they've got to spend a lot of money on advertising. They've got to hire the best creative professionals, because they can't exactly talk about the features and benefits, because the features and benefits are misery and ill health.
You're the first one who actually put features and benefits. That's usually a term we use in sales training. But I love it when you presented that in this discussion, because, as you said, there is none, right? You know, let's see the feature. Well, the feature is that, you know, you get drunk, and the benefit is you're going to have a bad migraine and bad, you know, liver at the end of the day. So, I mean, you're right. It just, like, it could be very interesting just to even think about that. Well, you know, listen, I mean, you're doing terrific in terms of sharing this value, and at least, you know, we're having some fun with this discussion, but I know that people, you know, who may be drinking, who may not be drinking, but at least I can tell you, there is no one that exists today that does not know someone who drinks? I think we all know someone who drinks, right? We work, our colleagues work. I mean, I've always been the designated driver because I don't drink, but that means everybody around me is drinking when we go out to events and things like that. So you go to galas, you know, your people are drinking, right? There's a bar, there's an open bar. You go places. I mean, it's almost everywhere, right? You go to the games, you know, I don't know, the Yankees for us. You go to, you know, Manchester United. I don't know, one of the games, you know, the big ones in the UK. You know there's plenty of beer and action going on with some hot dogs and, you know, crisp, as you call them, chips, whatever, you know, all this stuff. It's become like almost iconic. You have a party, beer's got to be there, six pack, you know, it's almost like, you know, a standard thing that you have in movies. It's very well portrayed and in anything, you know, you're talking about cocktails. I mean, you know, you have James Bond, right? Stirred, whatever, not shaken, you know, so that's iconic too. So it became part of culture. And by the way, it's not became, it's always been that way. I mean, but I think there's a shift in like the original wineries and wine and alcohol, you know, ingredients and things, how they were in the past. They were natural, you know, grappa, grape, you know, making their own fermentation and so on and so forth. So the process was different. Now it's industrialized and it's really just, you know, more alcohol and less, you know, good stuff. So it changed. And by the way, that goes also for food, for everything. I mean, you know, we can have different chapters about this discussion because it's sad, you know, that, you know, it's funny, like this last year, you know, I started the Nutritious channel, right? And I've become a lot more aware of all the bad stuff that's out there that before then. I mean, literally a year ago, I would have not thought about the bad stuff that's out there as much as it is and has been. And I just learned, you know, through some of the work here that the food industry, you know, they got started by tobacco companies and scientists kind of moved into the, you know, when you start thinking about this stuff, like, what the hell's going on here? And it's sad. It's all about money, profit, and it makes money to other industries. I mean, obviously, people get sick. Healthcare is cool. You know, it's cool. Pharmacy's doing good. You know, there's benefits to others, to other industries. Yet, you know, it's not really beneficial to the individuals. Family divorce, you know, potential loss of life. I mean, accident, DUI is a big deal, right? People kill each other on the road because they're drunk, right? You know, this stuff is actually happening. You know, you can get a little alcohol buzz and now you're in a bar fight and then you're in jail, right? So there's all kind of bad things that can happen to us as humans with the I guess attribute of alcohol. You know, we should be able to not have it. Obviously, it's part of the society. Now, there are ways to do this, and the one way is individually taking a stand, right? Now, you've written a couple of books, you know, or more than a couple, I think. There's a few books. And one of them is right behind you, Real Man Quit, right? And that I love that title because, you know, like I can't quit. I'm, you know, I'm a macho man. I, you know, it's my cool. I got to look like, you know, the part. Because when you go to a party, it's like, oh, you don't drink? Oh, my God. And by the way, I used to get that all the time. I mean, they come to me like, you know, you don't drink? No, I don't. What is that, religion? I happen to have that religious aspect of it, but I do it also because it's my help. I just know it's not good for me. You know, yes, I mean, you can look at it from there. But even without religion, the fact is, I don't drink because I know all the bad stuff. And I've seen bad things happen. I mean, I've lost a beautiful soul, a cousin of mine, to alcohol. I mean, literally, he died of alcoholism, you know. So I can tell you, I've lost my family members to drugs and I've lost family members to alcohol. So I can relate to this, you know, personally to what it is. And it's not a good way to see someone that is top notch going down the drain quickly. And it does take a toll on someone. And eventually, if you can't afford it, then you start getting the cheap stuff and the worst stuff that's available. And that gets worse and worse and it destroys your body. So it's very dangerous. Now, let's talk about your books, man.
Yeah, so I wrote Real Men Quit, you know, for a lot of the reasons that you just outlined. And that's one of the sad things is whenever I tell anybody what I do, they almost always have a story. You know, they know somebody, it's their son-in-law or it's their cousin or it's their dad or it's their uncle. And it's so often it's men. Because, well, you know, men drink. I mean, that's, you know, not simply the impression that I think we've both got. You know, that is the fact. The World Health Organization found that for every four drinks that were sold worldwide, men are going to drink three of them. So we are significantly out drinking women, which makes it unsurprisingly that, you know, we have significantly more drinking problems than women do. About 2 to 3 times more likely to develop a problem with alcohol, which reaches its absolute height if you are a white man like me. About 1 in 3 white men that drink develop a problem, which is pretty bad. And nobody ever told me that when I started drinking. I wrote Real Men Quit to try and do something about that, and to do something about the cultural narrative that you talked about. You mentioned James Bond. I talk a lot about James Bond. It comes down to these beliefs that we have around alcohol. You know, we believe that alcohol makes us sophisticated. It makes us more attractive to the ladies. It makes us a real man. I think a huge amount of people really believe that. And they really believe that because they've watched too much James Bond. And you've got to ask yourself, is that true? Again, it's not really true, is it? And again, there is an irony. The personal trainer that got Daniel Craig ready for all of his movies wrote an excellent book called Intelligent Fitness, which I'm sure a number of your listeners would really enjoy reading. I'm not so sure you'd enjoy doing all of the plyometric exercises he suggests you do, and you definitely don't want to get onto Daniel Craig's like 4:30 in the morning exercise regime before filming kind of thing. But I mean, that's, I think what it gets at is it shows you how hard and how dedicated Daniel Craig had to be to get to the position to, film those shots. When he was walking out of the sea in his trunks in Casino Royale, you don't look like that unless you work pretty hard. And actually, all of that hard work, it's very incompatible with drinking alcohol, isn't it? You can't go out for a few beers and get up at 4:30 and do all of those horrid plyometric exercises, can you? So Daniel Craig does drink, but he was drinking a lot less during the filming of all of the Bond films. Yet, of course, Bond heavily promotes alcohol, to the point that I think Heineken paid $45 million to have Heineken featured in one of the films. So the James Bond films are a massive advert for alcohol. They always have been. So you've got to kind of ask yourself, is your belief around it making you sophisticated and tough, is that true? And is there anything behind that might they be trying to trick you? So yeah, I mean, that's the basis of the book, helping you to get to grips with what you think and believe around alcohol through the medium of really bad jokes and a lot of film references.
It's funny because James Bond is, a British production, and it's an iconic movie and worldwide. I've seen all of them, since the oldest one to the newest one, right? And they're actually, great movies, action, all the stuff, and they live up to the expectation. But you're right, it is, there's a big portrayal to for alcohol and the alcohol industry and how classy it makes you. I mean, when they go to these big galas with the billionaires, there's top shelf drinks all over the place. And that's the other thing, like, even drinks, top shelf versus lower shelf kind of concept. I mean, even there's a hierarchy in the drinks levels. If you got what it takes, you get from the top. If you got no means, you go from the bottom, which is the cheapest stuff. We'll get you a little Uzi quick, but that's the thing, right? That book itself is really a guide, as you stated, to help people kind of see it for what it is, potentially get out of it. Now that, so let's talk about that. Like, most people will probably have a challenge getting out of it because it is an addiction. It's not as easy as it sounds. I mean, you've had a long run and it took a certain event in your life to kind of make the stand to, like, okay, this is it, I'm out. But it, I'm sure it was brutal in the beginning. It was a little hard to just get out of it. And a lot of people would relate to that, you know. So I think there's a fear of the ability. I mean, we have, you know, AA or Alcohol, you know, Alcohol Anonymous, you know, in the States. I'm not sure if you have them in the UK or in other parts of the world or similar. I'm sure there's some groups that are similar. But the fact is, you know, there is like almost like milestones that you do, like, you know, your first, you know, week, your first month sober, you know, your first year and all. There's anniversaries to keep. You have mentors, you have people like, you know, partner buddies to help you. It is a difficult process to get out of, you know, this addiction. And, you know, there's not a lot of real support from the industry. I mean, they tell you if you have addiction, call this number. I mean, that's kind of like the biggest thing we see, you know, out there in advertising, when it's like, if you have, like, we see it in gambling, drinking and smoking, like, you have this, call this number, right? All right, what are you going to do? They're going to give you some service that you're going to have to, but you have to go yourself through the process of eliminating that, you know, stuff from your body and the cravings and all the stuff. And the other thing is, again, you are suggested daily with alcohol, you know, stuff coming in into your face through, you know, streaming, you know, as you know, what do you call it? Applications these days. I mean, we stream movies all the time, so you have a lot of that. So you basically are all over. You go up billboards big time. You know, it's funny. So when I went to England, as I mentioned earlier to you, we also went to Ireland. So I was in Cork, and when you go right outside, like the main station there, there's a whole mural. Well, it's not a mural. It's a big Heineken. I remember like yesterday. It was a full, like, it's a side of a mountain, and it's all Heineken. You know, just to share with you, like, you know, it's like it's a big, you know, sign, like you cannot miss it. It's the whole wall, the whole kind of side of the mountain, which is just a big sign. So it is, you know, everywhere around us, and people have to get through that process. Is, you know, are there any steps that someone, according to your experience and your interviews with people who have been sober, that they can take, you know, minor, major, whatever steps they can, that you can advise people with, because your experience and expertise will probably come in handy here.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think, you know, you've hit on it really. You can't get away from it. It's not going anywhere. So, you know, whilst I would love the world to change a lot and make it easier for people to kind of navigate the world without drinking, you know, you've got to deal with what's in front of you. And that means, for my money, you know, you've got to find a way of being around alcohol, being exposed to alcohol, and not be tempted by it. Now, I think that if you don't want to do something, then it's actually pretty easy not to do it. So, for example, I don't think most of your listeners will, you know, expend any energy or have to use any willpower, or they won't find it difficult at all to not take cocaine, because they don't have any desire to take cocaine. So what I try to do with people is I try to get them to that point where they have no desire to drink anymore. Because if you don't want to do it, then it's very, very easy not to do it. And for my money, that's all about, you know, making that deeper change and getting to grips with your beliefs. Because what a lot of people do, and I think that's part of the reason why it is generally regarded as something that's quite difficult to do, you know, everything is difficult to do if you go about it the wrong way, isn't it? You know, if you imagine you're trapped in a prison, you can do the Andy Dufresne, can't you? You know, you can get a teaspoon and you can dig a hole, and it will take you 8 years. And at the end of those 8 years, you'll have to crawl through a pipe full of sewage, right? That's one way of getting out of prison. The other way is to just unlock the door and walk out. And if you just, you know, unlock the door, it becomes a lot easier, a lot quicker, and you don't have to crawl through the sewers. So for my money, it's about getting to grips with those beliefs, because those beliefs are what drive your actions. They're what drive that desire. If you genuinely believe that alcohol doesn't do anything for you, that it doesn't help you in any way, that it doesn't enhance your life, then it becomes more of a question of why was I doing it all of that time? You know, you really don't have any desire to do it anymore. I think most people go about it the wrong way. You know, they focus on the action. They say, right, I am not going to drink, and that's all they really do. They say they're not going to do it, and they sort of hope that the thoughts and the beliefs will catch up, and occasionally they do, but most of the time they don't. So I think if you approach it from the other direction, you start off with those beliefs, you don't change your actions at all, you just start off with those beliefs. You ask yourself, you know, is alcohol serving me? Is it helping me become the person that I want to be? Is it helping me live the life that I want to live? Is it living up to the expectations? Is it delivering on the promises? You know, once you've done that and a little bit around managing the thoughts, then the actions, they just fall away. The actions then become the easy bit.
Well, Duncan, thank you. And, you know, it's amazing. I mean, I love the analogy. You open the door. It's obviously the quickest way. Now, again, you mentioned prison. It's a little tough, but you're right. It is tough because, you know, I mean, the analogy actually does play, you know, play real, because it is a prison, because everyone around you, there is alcohol. So you want to figure out a way to get out of it. Now, you don't have a warden, you don't have nobody to stop you. You just got to figure out, like, you know what, I'm doing this, and you're taking that leap of faith to do it. And, you know, because again, there's you mentioned family earlier, right? You know, many people lose their families because of alcohol. Many people become aggressive, and even, you know, it gets to a criminal stage, you know, if you get into the stuff, you know, I mean, there's so much stuff that can happen, yet it can be stopped, but it is a long process. It is not going to be overnight, especially if you've done it for years. I mean, You did it for 20 years. Don't expect it to go overnight. I mean, it's just not going to happen, right? You know, even 1 year, it's probably going to be some time, you know, to get it out of your system. I mean, I think I've read some stuff. Like, if you were to stop literally not drinking, the alcohol will take about 40 days to just not be in your blood, right? So I don't know if that's an actual, you know, real, and someone can chime in on the comments and throw in some data to us. We love those things. But you know, these are, like, you know, important things to realize, that it's not going to be just gone. But I think the support, you know, knowing that other people have gone through it, knowing that there is, you know, huge numbers of people who are experiencing the same thing as, you know, a person who is having an addiction with alcohol, you know, can help, you know, to know that you're not alone. There's a lot of help out there. Maybe you can do something about it. And like you said, when you make the realization that life is better without it, and you can do better for you and stuff. And I've had actually great stories and great, you know, guests in the past who have similar experiences that were very bad, you know, at first, you know, with alcohol or even drugs. And then they made the huge, you know, 180 degrees into a better lifestyle and better everything, and coaching and stuff. And I admire that. I mean, and you know what? Listen, we all had something in our skeletons, in our closet, skeleton in the closet, as the expression goes. You know, we all had, a youth, you know, at a point, or we are still going through it for those of us who are much younger, you know, and that's the thing. An advice would be that maybe the younger crowd, the younger generation, should be a little bit more aware and educated. And I have to say, today's social media, today's podcast, talk shows, you know, there's a lot more awareness than it was back in the days, you know. So I think there is more opportunity for people to receive these messages and seeing for what it's worth, and then making some changes early on than back in the days. I mean, you know, sadly and good, you know, in a good way, you know, everybody is attached to their phones and cell phones, like, you know, everywhere, everybody is a social, but at least there's, you know, bad stuff in there, but there's also good stuff. And so if you come across a page or some sort of an influencer, somebody that is talking about this stuff, it can make a difference in, you know, people's lives, and hopefully get them early on to stop before it gets too late. And sometimes it's a good thing to know the outcomes are not going to be there, right? And, you know, and sometimes not just for you, your kids can actually take bad habits from you, and so on and so forth. So it can be a lot of, you know, problems. Now, I've got a question for you. You've interviewed some superstars who've been sober, you know, and they went through it. So what was that experience? Not interviewing, but, like, for these people, you know, because, I mean, I think stardom comes with price tag, right? You got to attend these functions, and you have to be cool and look cool. And sometimes for the sake of movies, you got to make those sacrifices and do the drinking, right? So what are some of the challenges some of these folks, you know, shared with you? And I'd love actually to potentially connect, you know, on the description, your shows and your interviews, you know, if they're available, so people can actually get to them and really kind of get a feel for what it is. And maybe, you know, one of your, who was one of the best, you know, in the top one that you've interviewed, if it's possible, sure.
Yeah, so I've interviewed a couple of very successful people in the movie business. A guy called Ted Perkins, who was a studio executive. He wrote a couple of films, and you know, absolutely, when we talked, he was talking about the kind of, actually, it is almost a part of the job in Hollywood. You've got to go to the parties. You've got to schmooze. And yeah, there's alcohol at all of them. You know, Ted, like a lot of the people that I've interviewed, you know, they were often really very successful, performing at quite a high level when they were drinking, you know, and then it gets to a point and something motivates them to stop. And then they generally tend to find a whole heap more success after they've stopped. You know, it for many of them, it takes the brakes off and allows them to kind of really pursue what they wanted to, what they were meant to pursue. You know, it gave their life so much more meaning and purpose, I think. And yeah, the thing is that there are so many similarities, and that's one of the reasons why I like to interview successful sober people. It's to kind of help other people on the road to realize what it is that they did that helped them to remain sober but also become successful. And there's an awful lot of kind of common ground. Self-awareness is something that comes up all of the time. That's absolutely a huge part of, you know, just understanding yourself. And of course, you know, alcohol is something that absolutely gets in the way of that. Again, you know, emotional intelligence, emotional resilience, those are important things that come up time and again. That also kind of leads on to improved relationships, connection. That's a very famous quote from a guy called Johan Hari. The opposite of addiction is not abstinence. The opposite of addiction is connection. And, you know, everybody I've interviewed kind of proves that. And, you know, in a deeper sense, yes, absolutely, connection to other people is important. And that's why group programs like AA are so successful, because, you know, they build that connection element into the program. But also there's connection with yourself. There's connection with meaning and purpose. There's connection with the natural world. So yeah, there's a huge amount of different experiences of the people that I've interviewed, but there's also a lot of common ground. And I think that's the message that we need to get out there to people. You know, getting sober, it's relatively straightforward. And it's interesting. There isn't a massive consensus of how long it takes your body to process alcohol and to get it all out of the system, because a lot of it is limited by what the tests are able to pick up in your bloodstream. I mean, you can reliably test alcohol in people's bloodstream up to about 5 days. It will remain in your hair for about 90 days. But even, let's just say, 40 days, that number you picked, you know, the majority of people that stop drinking, you know, they do 40 days. The majority of the relapses are not actually within those first 40 days. They're past that point. And that, for my money, hints at something more significant. You know, the problem, it does have a physical aspect to it. Absolutely. You know, withdrawal from alcohol is horrible. I mean, that's technically all a hangover is. It is the withdrawal effects of alcohol. But that, I don't think that's the problem. I think the majority of the problem is actually mental and getting to grips with, you know, the mindset, the belief, all of that. And, you know, helping people to build the kind of things that are protective that we know, because, yeah, scientists don't just sit around twiddling their thumbs, do they? They've actually done a lot of research into the kind of things that are protective. And many of them are around mindset. Many of them are around connection with other people. And many of them are around the kind of the physical nuts and bolts of life, access to healthcare, money, accommodation, access to transport, that sort of thing. So helping people to understand what it is that will protect them and keep them sober, you know, that's so important to me. That's That's kind of like a big part of my mission these days.
Well, first of all, I commend you for doing the work you're doing, the mission, because that's pretty good stuff. You're helping people, you're guiding people through talk shows and through interviews and books, and so it's a big, you know, you're making a difference, and you know, you're sharing value with people and real intelligence, you know, and statistics that can make a difference. And it's funny you said that, you know, it takes self-awareness as one of the common things. Now the ironic thing about that, if you talk to someone who is drunk, for example, they're like, I'm not drunk, right? You have alcohol, you're alcoholic. No, I'm not, you know. So when you transit and really realize, like, oh, I have a problem, that's when it becomes, you know, the shift, right? But really, the obvious or the more common thing, when you talk to someone, they will deny that they actually have a problem with alcohol until they realize that they have a problem with alcohol. And that is usually, maybe it's too late, maybe there's some big event that happens to make that change. But I love that the definition that you mentioned, the fact that it's the opposite of it is really connection, and you know, and connecting with the real world, connecting with what you, you know, the better part of life, and so on and so forth. It's a big, I think that's a powerful, just, you know, quote on its own to just keep and highlight, right? Now you do have another book, something. I mean, you know, let me see, I have it here.
Get Over Indulgence.
Although I was looking at the Armchair Macho Guide to Beating Booze. No, that's the one. That's The Real Man Quit. So what's the other one?
So Get Over Indulgence, that's kind of my story. It's a little bit of a gentle nudge in the right direction. It's mostly quite funny. It's you know, I don't want to kind of spoil it by saying you can learn something reading it, because it's a story. It's my life kind of thing. It's how I went from, you know, drinking, smoking, eating junk food into happiness, health, joy, peace, all of the good stuff. And yeah, it's very short, funny. And yeah, that's my, I set out to write something that people would actually read. So short and funny was where I kind of aimed for, and I really like it when people tell me that they read it in an afternoon. That's one of the nicest things people say to me.
It's encouraging, because it's, you know, I guess short enough that people can just get in and immerse themselves for a couple hours and it's done. But you get absorbed, because sometimes you get intimidated with a larger book. You're like, oh, this is going to take time, I got to figure out. And so you don't get started with it right away. But if it's something you can just, you know, browse through, you know, quick, it makes a difference. So, yes. And, you know, and again, these real stories, they can make a difference, because, you know, it's not fiction. It's not, you know, sci-fi. It's real stuff. It's a human who actually has, you know, been through this, and they share their life story, and it makes a big difference. I think we learn from everybody around us through their personal behavior, personal stories, and personal, you know, touch, right? You know, discussions, whatever they share. I mean, when we share in this information, there's a lot of it that we, you know, kind of report back from our own lifestyle, right? Our own life, you know, experiences. So it's an important piece. So thank you, you know, for sharing that. Now, are there any statistics, anything that you didn't mention, you know, yet, that we can share with our audiences? That, you know, I know we talked about, you know, the industry and male versus female, but anything else that we missed?
Any of my favorite statistics that I haven't dropped in yet? That's a good one. So, yeah. Oh, well, I can go on my little rant about opioids, if you like, because, like, I know opioids are devastating and cause an awful lot of pain and suffering in America. And, you know, I don't want to do down that suffering in any way, shape or form. But the brutal fact is that opioids kill about 80,000 Americans a year. Alcohol, on the other hand, kills about twice that. So I think we rightly talk about an opioid epidemic, but I wonder sometimes why we don't talk about an alcohol epidemic, when it's clearly having more of an impact on society than opioids. You know, I think we do need to kind of reassess the way we look at alcohol and stop thinking of it just as, you know, well, it's just a bit of harmless fun, isn't it? You know, alcohol kills people. It is the number one killer of people aged between 15 and 49 worldwide. You know, and like I said earlier, if you are a white man, you have about a 1 in 3 chance of developing a problem with alcohol, which is not a particularly pleasing statistic. And I think we really need to kind of change our attitude towards it. And look, I don't want to ban the stuff. For one thing, it's pretty useful for cleaning your hands, isn't it, alcohol? But no, like, and if people want to have a drink, I don't mind. I just want them to know the truth about it. I want them to know the effect that it's going to have on them, not in the long term, but just, you know, the effect that it's going to have on them tomorrow, even those couple of drinks, the effect that it's going to have on your sleep, on your mood, on your energy levels, all of those kind of things. And honestly, if you think the juice is worth the squeeze, stick some vodka in it and ignore me. But, you know, I want you to know what low risk drinking actually looks like, what the effects are, so you're making an informed choice. Because I think far too many people, you know, we just see the way it's portrayed on television, and we just assume that that's the truth. And because our parents did it, there can't be anything really wrong with it. Because our boss does it, you know, it must be all right. I'd like people to know a little bit more about it so they can make more of an informed decision.
Well, thank you. I have to say, you got me with the opioid piece when you started with that. I'm like, and I love how you maneuvered that statistic in there, you know. As I mean, you don't see it. And I love what you said there. I mean, it's double. And why is it that we're not talking about it? And again, it makes you question. It's a big question mark as to why not. I mean, the answer is obvious. We'll keep it at that. It is big money. And that's all there is. When there's money, as you said, there's political, you know, connection, right? So it kind of makes it difficult to make moves and changes when, you know, you can sponsor these political parties or individuals into their seats who actually regulate stuff anyway, so they can make it easy for them, you know. And it's funny because in the prohibition in the States, right, politicians did that, right? It's like you can make them do and don't. I mean, it's amazing how that plays when you want to do and make a change about it. And even when they did, it's have illegal stuff going on. So, you know, it just shows that it's not going to stop. But I love what you said about the ideas, like you want to share with people. Now my funny thing, as you were talking about, like, just the two drinks and what they mean to you for that night. I mean, you could become a parent the next day. You know, that happened many times over, right? You know, and that could be a shocker for a lot of you, like, oops, you know. So that can happen too. So guys, you know, ladies and gentlemen, know this, you know, risk is there like everything else. We're not here to scold people or, like, you know, tell them to change their lives. But we're just here to share facts and, you know, for you guys to share the value and the insights with other people that you might think they can benefit from at least some of this discussion here, because it is real, it is happening, and it's going to change lives for good or better, you know, or worse, as a matter of fact. So it depends on how you go about it. And, you know, let's just be on the lookout for these things and be aware. I mean, awareness is everything. Self-awareness is one, but awareness as a whole and having knowledge about things is key. And I mean, it is an important discussion because it is happening all over. And again, it's not one part of the world, everywhere. Now, ultimately, in the UK, in Ireland, in Canada, in the US, I mean, you know, in Mexico, I mean, it's cultural. I mean, there's a lot of, I mean, Spain, fiesta is all summer long. I mean, you know, cerveza is big thing, right? You know, so it happens, right? You know, you go to Italy, wine is beautiful. France is, you know, a lot of vineyards. So it is, you know, big, and it does give some sweet life to it, right? You know, it makes it happy, parties and all stuff. But at the end of the day, we just have to be aware of what it does, what it can do, and how it can harm people and how it can avoid, you know, and that there is also solutions. And so thank you for doing that. Well, listen, we've exceeded an hour, I think. We did we? Yeah, just about. but you know, a lot of good stuff here to share with us today. Any words of wisdom you want to close the show today with?
Yeah, I just, you know, there's one thing I'd love everybody to to not just hear, but to know and to feel and to tattoo on their heart. And that is very simple. It's you are enough. You know, you are enough. You don't need alcohol. You don't need junk food. You don't need cigarettes. There's so many things in this world that you just do not need because you are enough. You have everything inside you that you need to live a happy, healthy, meaningful, fruitful, productive life. You know, you so much stuff you don't need and you never needed because you are enough.
And that is a very powerful message. I think that that is probably one of the best messages that I've heard, you know, in my life. And it is a big one. People, you are enough, as Duncan stated. And there's nothing more to that. I mean, it's as beautiful, as real as it gets. So Duncan, thank you so much for that. And I enjoyed this discussion. And I know it is kind of later in your part of the world right now. It's tomorrow for you. It's the future, you know. So I don't want to hold you anymore, you know, in terms of time. You got to go and relax and take a nap, hopefully good sleep. But certainly I want to thank you for the opportunity to come in, sharing your insights and stuff. The website that people can touch, you know, to with you will be, what is it, getover.uk? Is that the one?
Yeah. If you go to getover.uk, then you can download a copy of Get Over Indulgence totally for free. There's the PDF there. There's a Kindle version. And if you can stand listening to me for 3 hours and 45 minutes, there's the audiobook version. And as I said earlier, it is kind of short. It is kind of funny. So, you know, that's my gift to your listeners. I hope they enjoy it. And it is also actually a part of my website as well. So, you know, you can find out more about what I do there. You can find me on the socials. We're pretty busy on Instagram, LinkedIn and Facebook. So you can connect with me there. Got any questions? Always happy to talk about this kind of stuff.
Yeah, one thing I didn't ask you, Morris Dancer. I'm sorry, I had to, because, you know, as people will get to know you, I think that's a big part of your life. If you could just shed a quick light on that.
Yeah, so Morris dancing is a kind of traditional English folk dancing. And it is a little bit tied up with alcohol. And honestly, I started because it's a socially acceptable way of drinking in, you know, lunchtime, maybe even earlier than that. You know, a lot of the dancing that we do is at pubs and places where alcohol is flowing. So that was why I started. And then I stopped drinking. And I thought, oh, am I going to enjoy it? Is it going to be the same? But I'd made a commitment to the guys and I didn't want to let them down. So I went to a couple of events and I really enjoyed it. It was amazing. And it turns out that I actually do like dancing and I like the guys I dance with and I like the tradition and I like the sense of community and I like the places we go to. I like the events that we go to. And it kind of really struck me that actually it was never about the beer. It was always just about the people and the movement and the dancing. And we get to wear silly hats as well. So I do kind of enjoy that as well. And I think that, you know, that it, for me, it really sums up so much of life. We think that socializing, we think it's about the alcohol. It's not. It's about your friends. It's about being relaxed. It's about having finished work. It's just about going out and enjoying yourself. And you know what? Sport, it's actually about the sport. It's about the beer. It's about sport because sport is enjoyable, you know?
Well, Duncan, thank you. And, you know, so I forgot to ask about the Morris dance, but, you know, cause that is, you know, a very neat, you know, dance. And, I think I've seen it, you know, traditionally. So it's pretty cool. So yeah, folks, do check out, you know, Duncan's website. And of course, the book, I'm assuming, is available on Amazon and whatever the books are sold, right?
All good bookshops and some bad ones, but yeah, just put Real Men and Quit into Amazon and you will find us.
All right. Well, listen, Duncan, you know, it's been real. It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us, man. I had fun tonight. It was good. Thank you.
Yeah, me too. I've really enjoyed myself. Thank you.
All right. Well, there you go, folks. You know, we've had a good time. We've shared some insights. Duncan has really giving us a spin on alcohol and the good, the bad, the ugly, and why, you know, you're enough and that's all that matters. So that being said, we're going to be closing our show today. So I'm Hank Mills. We'll be talking soon. New day, new show, new topic.